You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The environmental group Greenpeace has blocked a huge British military supply ship in the port of Marchwood at Southampton. Peace Watch reached spokesman Stephen Tyndale, one of the protesters, on his cell phone from the inflated boat, the Rainbow Warrior.
We sailed up the harbour with the Rainbow Warrior, the Greenpeace flagship, and with four small inflatable boats. We dropped anchor on the Warrior at the mouth of the Marchwood port so that the two ships inside it can't get out. And we also used the inflatables to put some climbers on one of the ships that was the most advanced, the most near to leaving for the Gulf. It was a beautiful, calm morning as we sailed up this morning. Very unseasonal weather for the United Kingdom. I think that everybody on the Rainbow Warrior was apprehensive because it's not meant to be undertaken lightly. Any civil disobedience is a serious matter, and when you're disagreeing with the military, then obviously it has more severity. So I was certainly feeling apprehensive, but I was also feeling confident that what we were doing was right and that what we were doing could have a very positive effect on the debate here in the UK. So it was a mixture of apprehension and optimism. As we approached the port, things were very quiet. We were expecting to be intercepted much more quickly and with much more severity than we were. We got an escort from the harbour authority about 20 minutes before we arrived in the port. But there was no sign of the military, there was no sign of the police until we'd been here for a good half hour or so. So actually, it was quite quiet when we arrived here this morning. The real activity with helicopters buzzing overhead, with police launches, with Ministry of Defence launches, that didn't start until early afternoon, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
We launched the four inflatable boats, and during the course of the day, Those small boats have been coming and going. Different people have been going out on them to take a turn because the weather's turned now quite cold. And we will be doing the same through the night. People will be going out in the small boats and we'll see what tomorrow brings.
Now tell us about this ship that you're actually blocking.
It's a large container ship. It's not a military ship. It's been chartered, we guess. And it's being loaded up, as I say, with trucks and helicopters and other parts for the potential conflict.
And do you know for a fact that it was actually headed to the Middle East?
Yeah, the Ministry of Defence have confirmed today that it is heading for the Gulf, that it was due to leave today. Obviously, it left today, so we successfully held it up and at least partially slowed the momentum towards war.
And what is your position now? Are you actually sitting on the Rainbow Warrior?
Yeah, I'm on the Rainbow Warrior, which is still in exactly the same place, blocking the entrance to the port. All of the climbers who were on the ship have been removed now, but for as long as the Rainbow Warrior is in place, they won't be able to move the ship.
So how did they respond to your action? Were there any threats of arrest? Have any of your individuals with your group been arrested or charged with anything?
There have been no arrests so far. In fact, the four people who were on the ship were removed and held briefly and then released without charge. We've been warned that we're in contravention of the local harbour regulations. We actually haven't had any, on the Rainbow Warrior, we haven't had any direct communication from either the police or the military, only from the harbour authorities.
You said earlier you have put climbers up. You had Greenpeace climbers who actually did what? Did they attach themselves to the supply vessels?
Yes, that's right. One went up a crane on the supply vessel. One hung off the side. Another got onto the deck and was removed quite quickly. And a fourth stood on the bowl, which is a bit of the ship coming out of the bows.
That sounds a little dangerous to me, Stephen. I don't know.
Well, the ship is not moving. It's still in port, so none of it was dangerous. The climbers are all professional, trained climbers, and are very careful. Safety is important to us. And they all felt very strongly that this was the right thing to do, so they were prepared to do that.
What exactly have you accomplished by doing this? I mean, won't they just get another ship? And you said you've blocked the port.
Yeah, well, what we think we've accomplished is, first of all, we've stopped this particular ship from going. We've drawn attention to the fact that there is very, very strong feeling here in the United Kingdom that war with Iraq would be a humanitarian catastrophe. Up to 500,000 people could be killed, that there are much better ways of dealing with weapons of mass destruction based on diplomacy and international treaties, which unfortunately our government and the Bush administration are undermining rather than strengthening. And we have shown that British people are not prepared simply to sit back and allow Tony Blair to take us into a war with Iraq, which most people in the United Kingdom do not support.
Well, what are the recent polls saying? Would you say that your position is in the minority or the majority there in the UK?
Our position is in a majority. Most of the polls show that just over 50% of the British public are opposed to a war. About between 20 and 30% support a war, and the rest are undecided. So our position is a majority.
How far are you and the other members of the Greenpeace team willing to go, Stephen, to try and prevent your government from supporting this war? I mean, this is pretty dramatic action here.
Well, Greenpeace is nonviolent, so obviously everything that we do will be nonviolent. We believe that civil disobedience is important and valid as a way of protesting and a way of showing how you disagree with your government when necessary. So we will continue to do actions like this to try and stop the war breaking out for as long as we can.
Mm-hmm. And do you have food supplies on your inflatable boat? And how long are you intending to stay there?
We have plenty of supplies at the moment, but we don't anticipate that we'll be allowed to stay here for too much longer, and certainly not indefinitely. The Ministry of Defence said that they wanted this ship to leave today, and it obviously hasn't. I'm sure they're going to be trying to get it to leave tomorrow, so we're anticipating that they're going to try and move us out of the world.
So in your definition of civil disobedience, how will that play itself out in this particular situation?
Well, we will, if they come on board to arrest us, we won't resist arrest. If they tell us to move the ship, we won't move the ship ourselves. But if they attach a tow rope to it and cut our anchor chain, then again, we won't actually try and prevent them from doing that.
Okay. Any final thoughts on your part, Stephen Tyndale?
The important point about today's action is to draw attention to the fact that war with Iraq would be both immoral and dangerous and have disastrous consequences both for Iraq and potentially for the wider world. And if our action can not only stop this ship leaving for the next day or two, but can also strengthen the forces that are arguing against war and in favor of peaceful political solution, then the action will have been very worthwhile.
Stephen Tyndale of Greenpeace speaking with Peace Watch from the Rainbow Warrior, the Greenpeace ship that blocked the British military supply ship from its intended destination in the Gulf. Voices from the United States Against War and Imperialism addressed a packed auditorium Sunday during the World Social Forum in Brazil. Audience members included students from Colombia and journalists from Palestine, as well as labor organizers from Germany and Argentina. They came to hear a panel of speakers that included many of the major organizers involved in the growing anti-war movement in the U.S. Editor of the International Socialist Review, Lance Selfa, moderated the event.
I know for me personally, being here, running into people throughout the weekend who are ecstatic when they run across somebody from the United States who is willing to voice opposition to George Bush's agenda, willing to voice opposition to the war, willing to extend solidarity to movements struggling in Latin America and elsewhere. And I think that our message here today is in part that behind us stand millions of people in the United States.
Salfa recalled for the audience last weekend's anti-war protests across the country before introducing the panel of speakers, which included Renea Masri of the Southern Peace Research and Education Center. In her presentation, Masri explored the great discrepancy in the United States between public sentiment and the mainstream media on issues related to the war.
In the speaking events that I do across the country, there has not been one audience, and I mean that exactly, there literally has not been one audience, from conservative right-wing Republicans to anarchist and socialist, that has disagreed with me with regards to the war. I have not met one audience that has supported this war. I have, however, not met one mainstream journalist that has opposed the war. There's a huge discrepancy. Recently, I was on a right-wing talk show program in which the talk show host, a woman, to make matters worse, was accusing me of not caring for Iraqi women because I oppose this war. She said, I oppose the liberation of Iraqi women. She said, I don't care for them because I oppose bombing them and destroying their homes and killing their children. And I just thought it was ludicrous. And when I was trying to explain to her that this is a war about oil, she called me naive, pessimistic, and paranoid. And she went on to interrupt me, which is typically what they do in mainstream press. But we know this is a war that has a lot to do with oil. We know, for example, that the U.S. Supreme Court's appointed president and his chosen administration are basically oil men and women, former and current, including Condoleezza Rice, who had a Chevron oil tanker named after her. They then asked the oil tanker to remove her name because it was bad publicity. But if we are having difficulty explaining to the mainstream media that oil has a big part to do with this, imagine the difficulty we have in explaining to the media that this is a war that goes beyond oil. This is not simply a war about oil. This is a war that also involves redrawing the maps of the so-called Middle East. I hate that term Middle East, by the way, because it makes the reference of the Arab world, which is where I'm from, related to England as if England is the center of the world, which England is not the center of the world. So we are neither Middle or East to no one. We are the Arab world in and of itself. But it is extremely clear by looking at documents from the U.S. administration, both before they got to power and right now in power, by looking at documents from the think tanks that they support and that support them, that this is a war that involves redrawing the maps of the Arab world with two main objectives. Controlling the flow of oil, yes, and ensuring Israel's continued regional military and economic superiority. And we cannot leave Israel out of the dynamic. Now, Arabs, we are still suffering from the last time they partitioned us, from the 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement. There have been numerous wars that have erupted partly as a consequence of the 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement between the empires of the French and the British that led to the present-day borders. And now they want to divide us further. So this is definitely something that will not only affect the Arab world today, but will have immense consequences on the entire region for a long period of time. But of course, the U.S. administration and the U.S. media, and here I'm specifically stressing when I refer to the media as the rich media, the corporate media, and not the left-wing alternative press. But both these institutions are not talking about the reasons of the war. Instead, they give the American public a continuing, changing list of reasons. They tell the American public, this has to do with democracy. Oh, you don't like democracy? Okay, this has to do with weapons. You don't like the idea of weapons? It has to do with stability. What about liberation? Which one are you going to accept? Which one will you regard as a good enough reason? Because the war has already been designed. What they have been telling the American public, though, is how they're planning on this war. 250,000 U.S. troops to invade Iraq from three different locations to possibly occupy Iraq for up to 10 years. Condoleezza Rice herself has told us that she wants to plan this war similar to the model of Afghanistan. The model that the U.S. administration and the U.S. mainstream media has told the American public was an extremely successful model. Because, just like Medea said, nobody died. We installed democracy. And women were liberated. That sounds so great. Why would we be opposed to it? We were not told, of course, of the civilians that were killed, of the people that were suffocated in trucks, of the civil war that is erupting, of the increased narcotics trade in Afghanistan. We were not told that. Nor have we been told anything about what is already happening in Iran. When we talk about the suffering of the Iraqi people, just as Medea stated, the Iraqi people will die in an extremely large number. it is not simply that. It is on top of the number of Iraqis that have already died from a 12-year war of sanctions. This is what we have to remember. According to the United Nations, between 1991 to 1998, approximately 500,000 Iraqi children under the age of 5 have been killed due to sanctions in Iraq. US, UN imposed sanctions on Iraq. 500,000 children under 5. And they're planning things further. For 12 years, Iraqis have been told that sanctions have been a, quote, peaceful alternative to war. And now Iraqis are being told that war is the only solution to end these suffocating sanctions themselves. But they're both wrong. Right now, the U.S. strategy is if we find nothing in Iraq, then that is something. Because that means they're hiding something, because we haven't found anything. And if we find something, that means they were hiding it all along, which is the something. This is the U.S. strategy. The U.S. administration has also told us, very quietly though, of the weapons they plan to use. There is the possibility of using nuclear weapons against Iraq. The U.S. administration has already said there is the possibility of using so-called tactical urban nuclear weapons against a population that they cannot even prove has any weapons at all. They have told us what they definitely do want to use against the population of Iraq. We know that in 1991, the U.S. government used depleted uranium against Iraq. Depleted uranium, which is a nuclear waste byproduct. It is, according to the U.S. Army, highly toxic, and its toxicity cannot be altered or changed. It is, according to the U.S. Army, a carcinogen that causes cancer. It is, according to the World Health Organization, already embedded in the food chain in Iraq. And that is because of the weapons they used in 1991. And now they plan to use weapons that have depleted uranium and that are much worse. They plan to use a weapon made by Lockheed Martin that will, it's a bunker buster, so-called bunker buster, that will penetrate 150 feet below the ground, and it has depleted uranium. If you can imagine what this will do to Iraq's environment, let alone Iraq's population. They are planning to use cluster bombs that are known to only kill and maim civilians and not to destroy buildings, and they want to lace these cluster bombs with depleted uranium. So not only will they be killing and maiming civilians, but they will also be injuring them for life in numerous other ways. We know, as was stated by Kevin, of the numerous consequences of these weapons on U.S. soldiers. Of the 500,000 active duty veterans in 1991, 149,000 are classified by the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs as disabled. 149,000. The head of the National Gulf War Resource Center, the largest grassroots organization for Gulf War veterans, an organization that is opposed to this invasion and opposed to the sanctions. He has said, we are now 11 plus years after the last Gulf War, and I get calls every day from veterans who cannot work anymore because they are so ill. Their families are falling apart, they're losing their homes, and they cannot get access to the Veterans Affairs. He asks, is this what we want with this next generation? And I ask, well, what about the generations in Bosnia where we use depleted uranium? What about the generations in Kosovo, the generations in Afghanistan where DU was used in the U.S. bombing? What about the generations in Vieques, Puerto Rico, where depleted uranium is being tested on the oldest colony in the world? What about the generations in the United States where depleted uranium is being tested, such as in New Mexico where we have indigenous communities, low-income communities? What about those generations? And what about the generations in Iraq? But of course, we don't talk about this. Nor do we talk about how this will impact the Palestinians. When we have Israeli academics, 800 Israeli academics have told us that the Israeli military is planning, under the fog of war, to cause another ethnic cleansing, another genocide against the Palestinians, to try to remove millions of Palestinians from their homes once again in the occupied Palestinian territories. And they are begging us to keep our eye on Palestine. And I am begging you to keep your eye on Palestine. Already today, we have had 15 Palestinians killed in Gaza. And we are tremendously worried about what the future holds. Already just a week ago, 62 shops were destroyed in the West Bank by by the Israeli military. Already in Gaza, we have 5,700 Palestinians who have been made homeless by the Israeli military since the start of the Intifada 2 years ago. And Palestine and Iraq are linked. And Ariel Sharon, the Israeli Prime Minister, has told the U.S. government, after you destroy Iraq, Iran is next. Because Iran doesn't have a democracy, but of course, we as Americans are never told that Khatami, the leader of Iran, has greater democratic representation than George Bush has in the United States. So if there is any regime that should be changed, it is ours in the United States, not anyone else's.
Renia Majri of the Southern Peace Research and Education Center addressing the World Social Forum in Brazil. That segment was brought to us by Pacifica Station KPFT reporter Renee Feltz with assistance from the Brazil Independent Media Center. A conference in New Mexico recently brought together military, intelligence, and terrorism experts from around the United States, Israel, and India. The Federal Weapons Lab, Sandia National Laboratories, brought experienced war makers together in Albuquerque to discuss the metamorphosis of war and how to fight small clandestine groups. But as Joe Gardner-Wesley reports, some of the arguments these war planners are making resemble the arguments of the anti-war community.
Our asymmetric response to the terrorism spawned in the Middle East must be a reduction in reliance on petrochemicals. This can be accomplished through conservation of consumption as well as development of abundant alternative energy sources.
Retired Army Colonel John Alexander was urging Sandia Lab scientists to develop alternative energy technologies recently, just as consumer advocate Ralph Nader once did in the 1970s. Yet Alexander is no pacifist or green. His current book, Future War, features a foreword by Tom Clancy and discusses using non-lethal weapons as a way to give more options to invading American forces.
By doctrine, we do not use non-lethal force independently. You always use lethal force with lethal force behind it.
These have been busy times for military planners as the so-called war on terrorism has put U.S. forces on the ground in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the Gulf region around Iraq. Retired Navy Colonel and Sandia Labs employee Dick Burcham organized this conference on strategic indirect warfare. Burcham says these military analysts find themselves in a dilemma as they ponder the metamorphosis of war.
One of the problems we have today is there's 25 to 30 different definitions floating around for terrorism. And terrorism is, in effect, a form of psychological warfare. So how can you have a war on a form of warfare? And if you can't define what terrorism is, then you can't define or have a central definition for terrorism. Then you have no way of telling what you're fighting. And if you have no way of telling what you're fighting, then you have no war plan. And if you have no war plan, then you have no peace plan.
The dilemma Burcham describes is not unlike the criticisms peace advocates have made since the military buildup following the September 11th attacks on the East Coast. He also echoes civil libertarians by criticizing the USA Patriot Act and U.S. Northern Command, an umbrella military command formed in 2002. U.S. Northern Command, or NORTHCOM, is responsible for the land and sea defense operations in and around the U.S., Mexico, and Canada.
There are Fourth and Tenth Amendment questions that should be raised and discussed with regard to such things as U.S. NORTHCOM that were never discussed or debated, with regard to such things as the Patriots Act that need to be discussed and debated, with regard to such things as data mining of all credit card purchases within the United States. Isn't that some sort of an illegal search? That's a warrantless search.
Now we have to be prepared to deploy anywhere in the world, and if terrorists are smart, they will go to the failed states in the world. So it's immature theaters. It's very undeveloped places. In fact, it's places we would have liked to have ignored if we could have gotten away with it.
Speaker Tom McNair is part of the RAND Corporation, the U.S. Army's officially funded think tank. He sees similarities between the Army's mission today and its mission 30 years ago.
To me, today's overseas war on terrorism looks a lot like Vietnam. You look at the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. I spent a certain part of a year on a border in Vietnam trying to stop small groups from infiltrating. That's essentially what we're doing now on that border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, while at the same time, of course, we're involved more and more deeply in political stabilization, the rescue of failed states, if you will.
Another speaker had intimate knowledge of failed states. Milt Bearden was the CIA official responsible for arming the Afghan Mujahideen during the 1980s. In a talk titled Afghanistan, Graveyard of Empires, Bearden described how he thinks U.S. Army and intelligence teams should work with warlords to rebuild Afghanistan.
We as Americans are going to push an election in about 9 months to a year. We're going to give them a couple of parties, you and you, eeny and meeny, and we're going to have an election. Maybe then we'll say, out of here. I doubt it. But, you know, graveyard of empires, they're not going to kill us. We still, you know, have a deep blue sea between us. But what happens there is going to impact how other people want to come and truck with us if we go into Iraq. If we can't do this, you think we're smart enough to handle Mesopotamia, for Christ's sakes?
But conference goers didn't limit their visions of social engineering to foreign lands. Speakers like Ben Steubenberg, chief of the Office of Asymmetric Threats at the Department of Defense, talked about how to reorganize society to defend against what he called the democratization of destruction.
One of the things that we have to do here is, I think, start out by wargaming things. Think of the what-ifs, okay? What if they do this? What if they have this capability? What if they do this to us? Every single thing has to be thought out. Now, we're starting to do that. We see a lot of these things happening in cities and states across the country. If there's a biological attack, who are the first responders? What are they going to do? But we have to go beyond that. We have to think, how are we going to organize our society to mitigate that impact when it happens?
Also analyzing preparations for biological attack, retired Colonel John Alexander pointed to a convergence between military and law enforcement functions.
Mission integration, certainly within the military change, we've heard a lot about that over the past few days, and how military and law enforcement have started integrating their actions and how their actions start looking, you know, more and more similar.
It's important to note that the men with the freedom to make sometimes unfavorable observations about military action are retired officers. The question that remains is whether officers in the active chain of command will be free to heed their advice. And ultimately, speakers like John Alexander are most concerned with applying force effectively in combat to win what he calls World War X, a war he believes we have entered. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Joe Gardner-Wesley in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Hermes Rivera at UN Radio, Randy Zimmerman, Reem Kathuda, Keith Shaljian, and Adam Campy. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers, Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at PacificaArchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit Pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. We'd love to hear your thoughts and comments. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.